Previously on Lost.
You cannot change anything. You can't. Even if you try to, it wouldn't work.
Why not?
Whatever happened.
Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason. Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
Horse?
You know Morse code.
You gotta find me, John. You gotta find me. And when you do, you'll find him.
Who?
Jacob.
Two players. Two sides. One is light. One is dark.
We have to go back!
We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 5, Episode 4, The Little Prince. I have a question for you. What's the best type of chocolate in a variety box of chocolates with a secret gun inside? My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I'm representing the Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory and some toffee with nuts on top in that special chocolate. And then a very small gun.
My name is Joanna Robinson. I am representing what was originally a California company, now perhaps worldwide, See's Candies, the dark California brittle. And I am going to read to you the description on the See's Candies website of this particular chocolate. Buttery brittle with California almonds enrobed in rich dark chocolate with a big fuck off gun underneath. Actually, no, a water gun. I don't believe in guns.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Neil Miller, and if I were to receive a box of chocolates with a secret gun, the gun would be reasonably sized, and the chocolates would be chocolate-covered cordial cherries from a staple of my hometown, Cleveland, Ohio, Mally's Chocolates. It's all-time good.
Mm-hmm. What a delicious way to start a timey-wimey episode. We're here to talk about Lost. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. The podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or visiting the island for the very first time. Each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. The first is a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers. Then there is a second section called The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. If you look down at your podcasting device that you're using right now, you can see time codes for each of these sections, so you can skip around, revisit the parts that you like, or just chug on through with us right now. First of all, thank you for listening. It's the best way to support us. And maybe tell some friends who need something to rewatch in these difficult quarantine times. But if you'd like to support us beyond just listening and passing us on, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, and there you can toss us some money, and in exchange, we will toss you bonus content. There's a bunch of bonus podcasts. We do at least one every week. You're three Storm hosts. Joanna does two different bonus podcasts. There's Feels Like the First Time, which is taking us into comfort movies this month, and there's Chen Pop, where her and Dave Chen talk about things, life, and I think importantly to maybe draw you to go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, addressing whether or not there'll be any Cast of Kings in the future. If for some reason you're not already on that finger pulse Duncan Egg news, we used to be a Game of Thrones podcast. But hey, there's even more to do once you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers and become a subscriber. Like our movie club, Joanna got to pick this week, this month's pick. what are we slacking along with this month?
This week, our Patreon subscribers, I think it's, what is it? The maester level? I don't remember. Anyway,
I think it's small council.
Small council only. All right, $10 and above can hang out on Sundays once a month and watch movies with us. This month we are watching this Sunday in our Patreon Slack for the small counselors. We are watching Hunt for the Wilder People, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, and I thought it'd be really fun. It's on Netflix. Freshly on Netflix. This is from Taika Waititi before he sold out to Marvel. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, if you've never seen it, it is a fantastic film. Sam Neill, from Neill's favorite movie, doing the I hate kids routine again.
Still hating kids after all these years.
So Hunt for the Wilder People, great film that we will be watching with our listeners in the Slack on Sunday, 10 a.m. Really hope you guys join us for this one. This one means a lot to me, so I hope you're there. We are doing comfort movies this week. By the time you hear this, we will have moved on to our second of three movies that we are watching this week in the Feels Like the First Time Buffering Storm crossover Slack. Last night, we're recording this on Tuesday. Last night, Monday night, we watched Josie and the Pussycats. We nearly broke the Slack. There were so many people in there. It was outrageous. Wow. It was fantastic. It was really fun. That's a fantastic film. Everyone had a great time. And so Wednesday evening, we will be watching Pride in there, which is a beautiful feel good movie about this this effort in the 80s for this gay and lesbian group to support some out of work minors, striking minors in a Welsh community. And it's a really beautiful story. And then Thursday we will be bringing the comfort home with Paddington Bear in that Slack. So it's just like a really nice cozy hug time. And as Dave mentioned, Dave Chen and I get together. So like this, just like if you're like, wow, I want to hear Joanna yammer more. Well, have I got some bonus content for you. But if that's not what you're looking for, you could also just email us, hostatstormpodcast.com. You can go to our website, stormpodcast.com, to find out what we're up to. You can find us on Twitter at stormpodcast. You can leave us reviews. You can write us emails. We got a bunch of both that we're going to talk about both here in the calm and the storm. And of course, once a week on Saturdays, we watch an episode of Lost in our Patreon Slack. This week, we are watching This Place is Death, hosted by our beautiful and talented and industrious producer, Diana. So,
sounds like a fun episode.
This place is death. all right. So let us get to a couple reviews that we have. Starting with this one from Robert D27, 5 stars, the Storm Podcast is a blast, or a recurring bright flash that transports you to another time, mainly 2004 to 2010 US, when Lost was airing. A long overdue review. Though I learned the podcast while listening to Joanna Robinson plugging it on Decoding Westworld, I started my rewatch of Lost in October 2020 and just now caught up to the current podcast. The Storm is the perfect companion for someone rewatching or watching for the first time. Neil, Dave, and Joanna are knowledgeable, enthusiastic, and engaging. Each bring perspectives to the storytelling, Lost's strengths, and frequent flaws while still embracing the show. The podcast is clearly delineated into a calm section, which provides an in-depth discussion of the episode that is mostly spoiler-free, and a storm section where all Lost spoilers might be discussed. Joanna is very good, but the strength of this podcast is the great rapport between those three awesome hosts. So, I agree.
That's a very helpful review.
I know, it's a very informative review. Oh, I didn't mean I agree with the whole review. I just meant I agree that the strength is it's the power of three, as they used to say.
It seems it's very factual as well, I think.
Yeah. If someone's like, what is this podcast? Robert D27 is like, let me lay it out for you. All right. Joy Rainbow, 5 stars. Excellent listen. I started listening to The Storm because I was a big fan of Joanna. Thank you. And this quickly became my favorite of all her podcasts. You don't have to be a Lost super fan to enjoy this. The camaraderie between Neil, Dave, and Joanna is what makes this podcast so fun. Of course, their insight on Lost makes a rewatch or first watch even more rewarding. I recommend it so highly that I actually downloaded and logged into iTunes for the first time in over a decade just to write this review, and an extra 5 stars for all the Patreon bonus material. So thank you, Joy. And lastly, we have this review from Tracy. 5 stars, listen to Mushroom Dave put good into the world. I discovered this brilliant podcast during Joanna, Dave, and Neil's off-season tour and caught up with their stellar Game of Thrones episodes. The very first podcast I listened to was a Lost recap show about 14 years ago. Thanks to Joanna, Neil, and Dave for bringing me full circle and inspiring my rewatch. Keep doing what you're doing, and please don't fall down. So those are some lovely, sweet reviews from folks. Thank you so much. We love, like, mostly we love it when you read reviews, not just because it flatters our ego, which of course it does. Thank you so much for your nice things you say, but also it helps get the podcast in front of other people who might be doing a Lost rewatch and looking for a community. We love encouraging more folks to join us on the rewatch. So your reviews help get the podcast in front of their eyeballs. So thank you for your public service. And then we're going to hit some emails. Most of our emails are a little stormy this week, but we've got a few. This first one, I'm not going to read the whole email, is from Asa, I believe is the pronunciation of this name. And Asa was wondering if we wanted to talk about The Wilds, which is, well, it says off-season tour, and then it says The Wilds. And if we want to talk about it, and I have good news for you, Asa, we did talk about it on, once again, a Patreon bonus episode. So if you want to hear our thoughts, at least Dave and mine, I don't think Neil has had a chance to watch it yet. We talked about it in a storm chasing bonus episode, two weeks ago?
I believe that last week. If you go to fightinginthewilds.com, we did a whole section on The Wilds, and that one is free.
Also, if you go to Little Gold Men, no, I don't think I talked, well, I might have talked about it in Little Gold Men. Anyway.
I mean, I think you should listen to Little Gold Men talk about The Wilds. If you want to hear opinions about The Wilds, listener.
We got them for
boy,
you.
Boy, we have opinions about The Wilds.
All right. So then this email comes from Rory, and it's titled Lost and Alan Moore Trivia. I've been listening to the podcast for the last few months after starting my own rewatch and looking around online for a podcast. I have my Your Lost Story, a piece of trivia for you. I'm still back in season two of the podcast, so if you've mentioned the trivia later and stopped doing a people's story, well, fuck me then. My Lost Story. I was in high school. No. Three seasons later, we're still doing Lost origin stories. My Lost Story. I was in high school when Lost originally aired, and being a teenage contrarian, refused to acknowledge I wanted to watch it because everyone else was talking about it, and I didn't have the channel that it aired on here in the UK. Eventually, after graduating university, I found myself doing a two-day week university course in preparation for teacher training and had extra time on my hands. So I binged Lost all the way through in a pretty short amount of time and loved it. I think that way of doing it meant I didn't have time to process and theorize as much as I'd like to. But I also didn't latch on to my own ending that I wanted and found myself quite satisfied with the finale. Plus, I've never been one to discount a story based solely on the ending. And then here's some trivia from Rory. He says, at the point in the podcast where I am currently, there's a lot of discussion about the Watchmen TV show. And while I haven't seen that, I do have a small nugget of trivia as I'm a huge Alan Moore fan, hence not watching Watchmen. In Moore's The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen series, specifically the Century : 2009 volume, a poster can be seen advertising a new album by Driveshaft called Oh, Who Cares? This raises a lot of questions. Like, does Alan Moore like Lost and or therefore Damon? Does the Lost Island exist in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen? Did Charlie survive in this reality? Or, shudders, did Liam revive the band without him using his brother's tragic story for hype? Loving the podcast. On the off chance you read this, I'll hear it in a year or half or so at my current pace, Rory. Yeah. So, from the past, Rory, we call out to you. Thank you for your email. Did you guys know that bit of Alan Moore trivia?
I did. Because I am also obsessed with the comics League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And along with that, there's an online community that boils down to like one person publishing it, but people will do like little notes about what each panel's references are. And so trying to get Java into Alan Moore comics, I bought hard copies of all the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen plus those two reference books, thinking she is a lit major. Surely this would be up her alley, but it mostly is just something I've been using.
Okay. And what do you think the answer is about why the Driveshaft poster is in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
I think that... I'm going to say Liam revived Drive Shaft. That seems the most likely, but I do think that Charlie could be a presence in ghost form because absolutely Orlando's discovered the island.
All right. This email comes from Lauren. It's titled, I'm doing it. I'm finally emailing. Hello, hosts. This is my long overdue Lost / The Storm origin story. Come to you from sometimes not rainy Portland, Oregon. It is longer than I intended, and for that, I am sorry. Like many late 20s folks, I started watching Lost pretty young, tuning into the pilot episode after getting wrapped up in all the hype ABC gave us about this mysterious action-packed show that was maybe going to be like a sexy dramatized Survivor, but in an awesome way, as if anyone wouldn't find that awesome. It was the first TV show in my sheltered sphere of awareness that was an event. Highly anticipated, highly talked about. Theories and did you see the episodes abound with neighborhood kids and parents alike, sometimes even a watch party on someone's flat screen. What I wouldn't give to be watching Lost with friends now. I still have vivid memories of one particularly jazzed neighbor kid running around reciting Lost on at 9/8 central to everyone, giddy with anticipation with every week's cliffhanger and that iconic Lost boom, and how my baby bisexual heart just loved to look at, you guessed it, Kate and Sawyer, arms flowing, locks, bad boy, bad girl vibes, jungle of Kistery eyes. What a time to be alive. Anyway, I rode that early Lost high out through the end of season 4, but no further. I think the freighter explosion was too much for my heart to bear. R.I.P. Jin. Or maybe there were too many timey-wimey things to keep track of, and also what even happened to Claire. A while later, I heard the ending was quote-unquote not good, even quote-unquote bad, and I never even bothered to look up how things ended. Very unlikely. If I've given up on a show after being invested these days, bring on the storm. Flash forward to quarantine times this summer, working as a personal chef from home, cooking 5 to 7 hours at a time, and naturally filling all of it with podcasts, including Other Dave, Chen, and Joanna's Truth vs. Hollywood after missing their Game of Thrones banter and recapping. I had heard the storm was starting Lost and thought, wow, who has time for that, as Game of Thrones was ending. The irony was not missed on me remembering that this fall, but actually watching the show and those episodes didn't even occur to me at first. I kind of loved the remembering process and listening to your chemistry applied to the genius of Lost. No way was I going to listen to the storm and miss out on the full episode, so trying to piece together what the fuck happened was also a trip. After binging through the first season on the podcast on sheer will and fuzzy childhood memories alone, I brought up Lost to my partner enough times that he was down to watch it for the very first time. We didn't watch any other show or movie for a good 2-ish months, save for a weekend under the weather that was devoted to Lord of the Rings trilogy. It was a borderline obsession with my partner, and as much as I loved the idea of savoring the week-to-week watch, it was too great to watch him watch some of the show's most iconic moments and then get to continue to ride the mystery wave through the last 2 seasons and get a sense of closure with our Losties after all these years. That was great. You bet I cried a bunch. My only regret was watching in the order Hulu autoplays, which, as I'm sure someone who had the sense to look ahead and notice such things, is in 2 separate episodes that are missing 20-something minutes of episode that I can only hope would help tie things together a little better. We still haven't gone back and rewatched that uncut finale, mostly because we were so peeved, but it will happen. Anyway, enough ramblings for me. And she has some stormy thoughts about devs. Involving Desmond that we won't get into. And then there's like a second email that she sent really quickly that I want to read. It says, I would be remiss if I didn't remember to include this tearjerker. A few weeks ago, we finally had to put my partner's sweet old former street cat down. It was heartbreaking, but he lived a good, long, and well-loved life, and we were both incredibly grateful. There was a service that came to our house, all distanced and heavily masked, and performed the procedure peacefully at home with candles and a sweet little altar of photos. We sat with him giving loving and gentle words as he slipped away from heavy sedation into the light, and my partner smiled and said, sans his normal butchered Scottish accent, see you in another life, brother. And he was equal parts chuckles and sobs as we sent him off, and he told me a day or so later his next cat will be named Desmond. Okay, that's all the waterworks I've got for now. Thank you again for all you do. Never tighten up. So.
Aww.
Yeah. A cat named Desmond.
Also a good title for Lost 2. Neil, write that down.
A cat named Desmond. All right, our last calm email is some theory emails, a theory email from Trudy that I'm going to save for another week. So that's all our calm emails. And that is it, I think, for me. So I'm going to ask you, Neil, What happened on Lost this week?
Oh, so many things happened. This episode, The Little Prince, was directed by Stephen Williams, written by Brian K. Vaughan and Melinda Sue Taylor. This episode aired on February 4th, 2009, and it continues to take place on and around the island, which is hurling through time. Off the island, we first witness a flashback in which Kate decides to take Aaron into her care, and then 3 years later, we watch as she tries to figure out who is trying to take Aaron away from her. She is interrupted by Jack, who helps her in her quest and ultimately leads her to the docks, where Ben is there and finally admits to being the client. Close by, Son, Aaron, and Son's gun have also arrived. On the island, everyone is worried about the effects of time disease. John Locke proposes a trip to the Orchid Station, where he thinks he can fix the island. Along the way, our gang witnesses several notable moments in time from early in the series, including Sawyer watching as Kate assists Claire with Aaron's birth. It's a really good scene. Later, they narrowly escape some more timey-wimey danger, after which Juliet and Sawyer talk about their feelings. It's also worth noting that both Miles and Juliet have begun experiencing nosebleeds. We'll come back to that. The whole thing ends out in the ocean, somewhere else on the island, where a shipwrecked crew of French people find Jin floating, just floating, on a piece of debris. Among these French people is a young pregnant woman who, once they get back to the beach, introduces herself as Danielle Rousseau. Lost. Anyway, fun fact, this episode has numerous bloopers and continuity issues. One particular example is that the handwriting on the piece of paper that says Kate's address, 42 whatever street, I forget the street, it's different handwriting in the scene where Jack gives it to Kate than it was in the scene where Saeed takes it out of, I believe the character's name is Tony's wallet. So
Tony, the registered nurse hitman.
Right? At some point during the production, they must have lost the first note and then had someone else write it. Very funny. This week's calm question. So if you were a member of the Lost writer's room and you were tasked with picking a previous scene similar to the one that Sawyer witnesses in this episode, but you're picking a scene for John Locke to witness in the time skipping, what scene would you pick? And this comes with a rule. The only rule is that it can't be a scene in which John Locke was a participant. So he's got to be watching something that some other characters did on the island in a sort of live flashback. Do you have a John Locke scene that you, or do you have a scene that you'd like John Locke to hit? Joanna, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, go. Yeah.
It's Boondying. He wasn't there, and he should have been.
Oh, that's so. Right. That is a good one.
Yeah, that's what I was
Boondying, thinking. Which I believe is happening at
that same night. Yeah.
That same night. Yeah, okay. Dave, do you have any, what's your favorite?
Yeah, mine would have to bend time, but I think it would be fun if he was in the bamboo jungle watching Sawyer tell Jack about his dad.
Ooh.
Shirtless, sweaty Sawyer.
Hmm. I mean, I would love to revisit that scene, but well, what would it do for Locke? What would it do for John?
Why would it need to do anything for John?
Well, I mean, because the Kate scene did so much for Sawyer.
Right, but the whole point of John's position in this episode is that he doesn't need, he takes all of his pain and he makes it better. And mm-hmm. I don't think he, I don't think writing a wrong in his life would make him feel better.
Mm.
I don't think about writing a wrong, but maybe just I just don't know that he has ever really, really reckoned with what he did.
Boone was the sacrifice the island demanded. Joanna,
yeah, but maybe
so
he wouldn't feel
he
that way if he had
anymore.
To actually watch the kid die. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, no, the kid, maybe. I'm old, referring to Boone as a kid.
No. Watch the kid die.
In that vein, I think I have one. Mine would be that they are flashed and that all of a sudden John Locke is in the ocean floating and he sees the raft and then he sees a boat approach the raft and he has to watch Tom Friendly kidnap Walt. And this is how John remembers Walt.
Yeah, it's like, right, Walt. Walt was also special.
Remember when tall, dry Walt showed up to save John from a gunshot in a pit of bodies? Why is John continuing to not ask questions about Walt. Is what I'm
saying. What if John flashes out into the ocean, and oh my gosh, there's Joanna out for her morning constitutional swim, and he grabs her just in the nick of time. I know. Whatever happened, happened. But maybe whatever happened, happened except for Joanna. Do you know what I mean?
Well, maybe that's why they never find Joanna, because John grabs her and pulls her through time.
Yes.
Because if you're attached to something like, say, an outrigger boat or an oar or a gun,
you
take it with you.
Yeah. Or a Joanna. Yeah.
Or a compass.
Yeah. I mean, Helen was great, but she's no longer interested. So, like... Mm-hmm. Let's start shipping Joanna and John. Why not?
Sounds great. Through time.
Time displaced Joanna. I guess, we didn't really see a Joanna body. And as you've learned this week, if you're a calm listener, we've been doing real good to try to pretend Jin was dead for a long time. I think we did okay. I think Lost... abides by the no body, no death rule, but luckily I think it also knows it does, especially with the body of John Locke being rolled onto the docks at the end of this episode. As always with Lost, lots of questions, lots of mysteries. Where do we want to start with the Little Prince? I feel like it's a Kate-centric episode, so maybe we start off the island, because time stuff, instantly thrilling. Sawyer also has some Kate stuff on the island, but off-island Kate is in another legal snafu that is, from what I understand, legally impossible. So it's either...
another legal snafu that is completely fictional.
Exactly. So either Ben's lawyer is just being real mean and threatening Kate with a whole bunch of lies, or the Lost Riders, didn't put enough research into how demanding a blood test or shifting custody works to realize that there wouldn't be a way where a anonymous person could seize custody of your child.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really about anyone trying to get custody of the child, right? Because Ben doesn't want custody of Aaron. He's already fucked up one child that he stole, right? So, it's just about Ben intimidating Kate and spooking her and backing her up against the wall,
Ben probably assumes that no matter what, Kate is going to protect the secret. So she's not going to, go to another lawyer or go to the police, and that's why she's not gonna let the sheriff show up. So Ben knows that it kind of doesn't matter if it's real, it just Kate needs to believe it and not feel confident enough to seek a third party opinion on the matter.
She tells Jack, she seems like she doesn't even want to tell Jack,
And Jack's not even a good doctor, so I can't imagine his lawyering skills. We also, in this episode, are reminded that Jack has been suspended from being a doctor.
Yes. I think we're actually, this is where we learn that Jack is suspended for being a doctor. We could assume, given his behavior, but now we actually, learn that there's been some consequences in Jackland. But,
He doesn't get arrested in the hospital like he should have.
I said some consequences, but conveniently for lots of white male protagonists, consequences just at the time that he has to pivot to something to maybe save the world or, people on the island. So go Jack. He gets to focus on something else, which is being Ben's right-hand man, which the whole team I feel bad about. I understand we need to get back to the island. I understand that there's a woman with a giant pendulum that has put a ticking clock on this. And I like Ben's play with Kate. I just think a lot of trusting Ben is clicking into place. Maybe it's fine. Maybe it's because we're watching it week to week. But if there was actually 3 years without Ben in your life, and other things were haunting you. Oh, go ahead.
I think Kate and Son are rightly and Saeed, And yes. Hurley are all rightly like, I'm sorry, work with Hoomst now, right? Whereas Jack,
didn't we leave
like,
that guy on the island on purpose?
Whereas Jack, who's like fresh from trying to throw himself off a bridge, but the island wouldn't let him, you know, is like following any wandering star. Do you know what I mean? So like susceptible to coercion, as they used to say about old John Locke. That's where Jack is right now, I think. Susceptible to coercion.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, I don't know if this means Jack is somehow like broken, but there's definitely something that has changed in Jack where he has accepted that like they really do have to go back and he doesn't know how to do that. So I guess he's just got to follow what Ben says, which, you know, tough position.
Can I say something about the flashback structure in this episode?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I mean, like, I don't know how you guys feel, but I feel a little like I liked the Hurley episode this season, but for the most part, when we cut back to LA, I just want to get back to the island because there's so much fun, like, time travel stuff happening over there. And also what's tough is, like, with the Oceanic Six stuff in the previous season, there was still that, even though it was flash forward, there's still that fun tension between what was happening on island with like a Saeed versus what's happening off island with Saeed, like becoming an assassin or whatever it is, you know? But for the most part, like where we are right now, the LA plot line and the on island plot line are fairly divorced from each other, with the exception of this episode where they find a way to give us kind of a Kate, they give us two Kate flashbacks in this episode, despite the fact that they're not really doing flashbacks anymore. They give us the, you know, the decision to tell the lie on Penny's boat, a little like sort of cold open situation, right? And then they give us the like Claire giving birth to Aaron, which helps us remember that Kate was there from the beginning of Aaron's life and says stuff like, this baby is all of us, stuff like that. So like it's a way to, in this flashback less season, reclaim some of that storytelling capabilities, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, well, and they also pace it against the off-island narrative. So the off-island narrative, so we can be on Kate's side in the off-island narrative, because there's a point in this episode where they're like, oh my god, it's Claire's mom who's, you know, demanding like this blood test. And if it wasn't so close to watching Sawyer watch the birth, then my mind would have yelled even louder than it already just sort of mumbled to me, like, yeah, maybe they should give it to the biological grandma. Right? Like, shouldn't Aaron go to the actual family?
Absolutely.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. They stole a baby.
They really did.
It's also one of the sloppier, like, fake-outs of the series. Mm-hmm. Is this like Ben and Carol Littleton both having the same lawyer sort of thing? So
yeah, I mean,
there's only one lawyer in all of Los Angeles.
The only thing that makes it tolerable is that they immediately is exposed.
Dispense with it. Yeah.
Right. So they don't drag it. I mean, if this was something they dragged out for like multiple episodes, that would be
apparently
a real problem.
Reading the recaps that happened around this episode, apparently the previous season was super Carol Littleton heavy. Mm-hmm. So everyone like went into this episode being like, well, obviously it's her looking for the baby. So they got like a 20-minute sort of got you situation. Yeah. But
yeah. I mean, I also think that it's what you said about the flashbacks, the off-island stuff in this episode is true. I think the only thing that feels like it has any tension is, like, what is Sun going to do?
Yes.
You know, is Sun going to murder everyone or someone? So I think until you get to the end, yeah, this episode sort of just treads water with Kate's thing. And it's interesting because I don't, like, when they finally get to the end and Ben is like, yeah, obviously, it's me. It does feel very obvious, but I do remember the first time around, not entirely, you know, figuring it out until, you know, I guess until the conversation where Ben talks to the lawyer.
I just love that moment where Kate's like, oh my God, it's obviously Ben. And Jack's like, no, he's with me. He's fine. And Ben's like, no, obviously it's me. Come on.
Right.
No, yeah, yeah. It's me.
Jack,
it's a nice little moment to show how sort of, I don't know, ineffective Jack is at like reading what Ben's doing. You know, like Jack's just sort of going along with it.
And we love capable Kate. So, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Jack's really been taking this season off for the most part, thanks to some, you know, having to play second fiddle to the much more interesting Ben, who has an existing like power structure to get things done off island. And then like on island, we get all the jumping around, and it's not like we're flashing back to Jack moments.
I just saw one recapper refer to like Sawyer, Locke, Juliet, Miles, Dan, and Charlotte as the real Oceanic Six. Like those are the six characters I want to follow right now.
The Island Six.
Yeah, the Island Six. Sure.
Okay. Let's see. Ben telling Kate she's not Aaron's real mom. Is he Alex's real dad? Then that's a very good point. Let's talk about kidnapping babies. It seems like...
Let's talk about Ben's hypocrisy.
Yeah.
it seems like from the end of this episode, we have both kidnapped babies are potentially on screen, depending if you have a in utero person being on screen.
We're not getting into that conversation right now, right?
I mean, I'm just saying, you have two stolen babies appear in this episode, in theory.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Alex is, I guess, there, technically.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. But I don't know. There's this, it's again the question that I sort of brought up when Ben was given the 70-hour deadline. I love quippy Ben. I love mysterious Ben. But there's also a line that I'm going through with the off-island stuff where I feel this dread pull that they're unable to make real for me, and I think that's why it's kind of like falling flat. Like on the island, they're jumping through time, they're flaming arrows, there's nosebleeds, there's outriggers, like so much is happening, and then off island, Kate's sitting in a car for a lot of the episode watching.
I mean, it really feels like the off island is the. I think we might have talked about this a couple weeks back, but it's really just the shell game of like, are they going to get back to the island? If so, with who and how?
But not even in the fun way of like how the Oceanic Six got like that fun.
Right.
How does the Oceanic Six get off the island shell?
It's like
game?
How does Ben trick these people?
Right, because they're all. Everyone but Hurley is in one spot by the end of this episode, which is wild and fast.
And no one seems like they want to go, except for Jack, who is broken.
There's going to be a long episode next week where they just stand on the docks and ask the questions.
But anyway, I mean, yeah, the point is Ben tells Kate, well, he's not your son, Kate, which is, of all the hypocritical things that Ben has ever said, one of the most, given that he stole Alex and spent a lot of time reminding and like is on a revenge mission about his daughter Alex right now. So of all the things for him to call Kate out for, that one is the wildest. So, you know, but he's Ben. He'll say whatever he needs to say. That's his thing.
Yeah. And then also when I'm saying I don't like the stuff off the island, I'm just talking mostly about the Oceanic Six. I actually do like the Desmond stuff off the island. I forgot what happened last week just because I was excited about the Little Prince. Okay, do we have anything before we get into the island that we haven't talked about was kind of lackluster off the island?
Well, I do want to talk, I wrote down in our notes like the Kate of it all, because every recap that I read took it as, and I read several this week, took it as a point of fact. That, oh, here we go, it's a Kate episode, it's going to be a bad episode. Which I remember being the fandom response at the time as well. Like, oh, not another Kate episode.
Oh, the Kate episode.
And seemed to be the recapper. But I should point out that every recapper that I'm reading regularly is a man, just FYI. But, you know, I think there are more nuanced takes as to why, like, Kate doesn't work as a character in Latter Day Lost very well, like divorced from the love triangle. They have to like sell this swing to Kate as mom, to Kate as mom being her like main, her constant, rather than Kate as the linchpin of the Jack Sawyer love triangle. And
previously Kate as Climb.
Kate as Mango Girl, right? Like, so it's and this is the episode where they try to do that by giving us the scene on Penny's boat where she talks about like, we can't lose another Losty, or you know, or her being at Aaron's birth. Like, they're trying, but I'm just not sure they're landing it, and I don't know whose fault that is. But I just wanted to take like a really good faith look at like why Kate episodes were so hated at this point in the Lost trajectory, you know?
I have a guess, and you guys could maybe help me kick this into like a better working theory, but it's like in the pivot in dealing with Kate that you're talking about, it puts her in a position where there's something she can't run away from, and the show doesn't really deal with that, considering that Kate's whole like thing previous was she's always going to run, so much so that when she like leaves her LA house with Aaron, it's like, of course, you know, Kate's going to run. But that isn't dealing with the actual fundamental character switch, which is Kate decides there's one thing she can't run from. Like, it doesn't matter if it's a love triangle, doesn't matter if it's like a, you know, airplane in a safe somewhere. She can't run from Aaron, or she's decided she's not going to run from Aaron. And it's like the show doesn't deal with that, maybe because they have one eye on where they want Kate to be at the end of this season and just don't have the time to stop and take that lengthy pivot. But that's what feels off about it to me.
What do you think, Neil?
I mean, I personally don't think there's anything wrong with Kate episodes.
I mean, I don't like...
I wrote it. Damn it.
I don't like Eggtown.
Sure. So yeah, and I think there are some unique things about each one, maybe. I mean, I feel like there's you know, there's definitely like... Yeah, it just feels like it's a bunch of dudes and they're mad because Kate's no longer part of a love triangle. Now she's a mom, so she's less interesting. So there again, sexism.
Maybe.
Rears its ugly head.
I think like Jack, the show, you know, like Evangeline Lilly and Matthew Fox are on the cover of Entertainment Weekly, like right around this time. So mm-hmm. like they are still like very much in the hearts and minds of the Lost creators, the co-leads of this show. And so I think Lost feels like it absolutely needs a Kate episode, even in a shortened season. And while I will say, like, I always appreciate that there's always a Hurley episode, I don't know that we always need a Kate episode. Like, last season there wasn't a Sawyer episode. And, like, maybe last season there didn't need to be a Kate episode. Like, so maybe they felt like they needed a Kate episode, and the audience is like, it's okay. It's not that we hate Kate entirely. It's just, I'm not sure you have enough story for her to have a whole episode. You know what I mean? The way mm-hmm. that sometimes, like, the way that we didn't feel about the show for the most part then, but certainly now, we're kind of like, oh, a Jacka episode. Okay. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, I mean,
I don't know.
I think the original sin on Kate is that she should have been the lead. Like, she should have been the Jack character. And there's it's a butterfly effect. It sort of spirals away from there.
You know? We definitely would have gotten another horse episode if Kate was the lead.
I mean, the horse would have been front and center for sure. And I think that would have changed a lot of things for a lot of people.
Locke walks into the cabin and there's just the horse.
Imagine
like,
if
of
every,
course, Jacob.
Imagine if every Christian Shepherd appearance was a horse instead.
It'd be great.
Wow.
Kate's like, I'm with him.
It's Kate and a horse.
Okay, let me like I'm gonna look this up. We can move on to the next topic, but I want to look up who had there's an easy find for this. Who had the most episodes about them, right? Yeah, so number one, mm-hmm. easily Jack, obviously, but Kate's mm-hmm. number two. She has more than even Locke does, you know. So it's Kate, so it's Jack has Well, that's tough. Yeah, Jack has 25 episodes, and this includes sort of shared, so like some of the finales and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. So Jack has 25, Kate has 19, John has 18, Son has 15, and Hurley has 14. If you're a commie, don't do that math looking forward. Do you know what I mean? Don't worry about like how many you've seen and what's to come. I'm just here to tell you that like... you know, Lost definitely thinks Kate is the second most interesting character. I'm not sure we as viewers agree, even though I do like Kate a lot. Does that make sense?
So mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like, I don't know, slight. This feels slight in comparison to everything that's at stake in all the other episodes. This one, it's like the highest stakes it gets is there's a gun in the chocolate box.
I mean, we could talk about Dark Sun all day long. Dark Sun Watch yeah. is on. She's so scary in this episode.
Dark Sun's great. Dark Sun's got resources.
Jeff Jensen had a wild theory. He was like, I think Gion is dead. And Sun is like, he's like, she's, I mean, he had a lot of wild theories. Some of which were just like fun. This one felt a little dicey because he was like, she doesn't act like any mother would ever act. And I'm like, I don't think we should make assumptions about how any mother would or wouldn't act. Mothers contain multitudes. Mm-hmm. But I feel safe saying that Gion is, we do not have a dead baby off screen. Gion is alive and back home.
Do you think it has something to do with the pacing of this season so far, with regard to the off island versus on island? Like, it just feels like there's a lot more happening on the island, and the off island is sort of the slow, you know, I guess 70-hour plan that Ben has to pull off that's taking weeks and weeks. I think that probably has something to do with it.
It might, well. But it is and it isn't. I mean, like I said, they are all already, except for Hurley, at the dock, and Desmond's heading their way, and in this episode, the only lawyer in Los Angeles, Dan Norton, has said that Hurley's, you know, case is going to fall apart. So they don't even have to like spend an episode jailbreaking Hurley necessarily, right? His mm-hmm. case is just about to fall apart. So like, they actually are kind of moving faster than they might mm-hmm. otherwise. But well, it's just not as fun as like. Right.
And I think that's what it is.
Time, like, you know,
it's all, there's not a lot that is happening, and it's all happening very quickly off island. Whereas there's a lot of mystery and density and weirdness to what's happening on island. And I think that pulls the audience one way or the other, you know?
Yeah. This is like a misbalance of mystery. And the island is winning. By a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Never bet against the island. The island always wins.
Yeah, exactly. speaking of, let's get to the island, unless the most 2009 thing about this episode is still off island.
Oh, it is. I was reading Jeff Jensen's recap, and he, this episode came out February 2009, and he said he was describing Kate as sort of like a corny, optimistic, like something something, his description of her, and he's like, in other words, she's an Obama girl. And I was like, oh, we're in the Obama presidency of Lost. I had to look up when this episode came out, so we are just fresh off the inauguration of mm-hmm. Barack Obama.
Out
of the Bush years, out of the Bush years into the Obama years of Lost, so that's where we are.
Oh man, That's a timestamp.
So there you go. The most 2009 thing about this episode is Barack Obama's presidency.
All right. Charlotte wakes up, which is very nice after how last week's ended.
I mean, it's better than Charlotte being dead.
Yes, absolutely. And takes her a second to like sort of come to, and we learn this episode that Dan's theory is these nosebleeds have to do with how much time you've spent on the island, not consecutively, apparently, just some total time you spent on the island of mystery, and Charlotte is the one who was affected first. followed by Miles, followed by Juliet. It's our first corner. It's a new one. It is a Nosebleed Watch 2021. Charlotte, Miles, Juliet, and it all has something to do with being on the island. We know Juliet's been on the island for a while. That story we know. Charlotte and Miles, this is new information. Apparently, even 2 miles.
There's this segment on the Buffering podcast. You know that like Buffy the Vampire Slayer takes place on top of a Hellmouth, right? In Sunnydale. So they have this thing that they do on the Buffering podcast called Hellmath. And it has a little jingle. It goes like, Hellmath. I want to do a little Hellmath for this, right? Which is, so Juliet's been on the island, what, it's like a couple, 3 years, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something like that. You can email me if I got that wrong. But so she's been there about 3 years. So can we assume Miles has been to the island before and been there longer than 3 years? And can we assume Charlotte has been there even longer than that? I mean, it's all Dan's theory. But,
yeah, I mean, as to say, Dan might think so. And I think that's really important because, you know, Dan's very smart.
It'll be interesting to see if that theory continues, which one of our losties is put in jeopardy first with the nosebleed Hellmath. But yeah, keep an eye.
I mean, Charlotte spends most of this episode with her face smeared with blood that she like hasn't washed off her face yet. So I'm a little worried for Charlotte.
Oh, we should all be concerned about time disease. Time disease is very serious. But
have you or a loved one been affected by time disease?
This is out of order, but do you think Jin is racking up more nosebleed time, or do you think he's floating in this like magical space where he doesn't have nosebleed time, but he's inside the time bubble that's jumping along?
Yeah, and if he was unconscious the whole time, cut down on his nosebleed time? Because it seems like Charlotte is fine when she's asleep.
Yeah, maybe while you're sleeping, you don't rack up nosebleed time. can we do a quick tour of the flashes of this episode just to make sure that every like calm listeners know what's going on?
Mm-hmm. Let's. So we jump out of 1954 to the night of season one, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So 2004, September.
The birth of
Aaron. I don't know, maybe even an early Boone. October 2004 sort of situation.
Birth of Aaron, death of Boone, 2004. The Bush administration.
The Bush administration. Then we jump forward to find the camp has been ransacked. There are 2 outriggers, and one of the outriggers has a bottle for an airline called Ajira that has been teased in commercials surrounding airings of ABC's Lost at this point in 2009. That would lead you to a viral website for this fictional airline. It's based out of India that Juliet knows about. Placing this as possibly in the future. We haven't seen the camp ransacked. We haven't seen an Ajira plane. So future seems to be the position because the camp is still there. So we're going to say future.
Mm-hmm.
And then we flash again, and there's a young, pregnant Russo. It's time for some more Hellmath, Joanna. How old was Alex?
She's 16. Anyway, it's 1988. She's 16 in 2004, so it's 1988, right?
And then we end up in 1988.
So 1950s, 2004, future question mark, and 1988. And Neil has, I mean, this is similar to what Dave was asking, but like, what has Jin been doing since the freighter blew up?
Mm-hmm.
As Locke and Sawyer, et cetera, are hopping through time.
Well, and that's the interesting question about like, what were the logistics of when the island moved? Remember we talked about this a little bit because Dan is in the motorboat, the boat with the engine on it.
The Zodiac,
which disappears in this episode.
Because nobody was touching it.
Because no one was touching it to bring it with them to the future. So yeah, I guess he was just in the ocean on that piece of debris, how much time do we think real time for our island crew has passed? I mean, it's been less than 24 hours. No, more than 24 hours, right?
I can do that hell math
sure.
for you.
That is the real hell math here, which is how much time have Sawyer and Juliet experienced between when they saw the freighter blow up and when they find, I guess, when they find on the beach the French debris, which is, I guess we can assume is happening at the same time as Jin being brought back to the island by the French crew. So yeah, I mean, it hasn't been very long. I guess he could survive out there. I mean, this scene where we find Jin not only answers the question about Jin, it also answers some important, I believe, Titanic related questions about how long you could survive on a piece of debris. You know, so if we assume Jin weighs, you know, somewhere close to the same amount as Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet.
Yeah, 1.5 jacks.
I guess everyone could have survived, and in the end, Jin survives, which is all that's important for Lost.
Okay, according to Lostpedia, Oh, God, this is tough. Lostpedia no longer has that handy-dandy what day on the island, because I think it's also confused.
Right. I mean, that's why we've stopped counting them.
Yeah. It's hard to know, but let's hope it's not... Like, let's hope Jin was knocked out for, like, only about 48 hours.
Yeah, I would say that, like, 48 hours is the maximum that he's
been basically out. I think, like, my interpretation is that he's been drifting on some freighter debris out in the ocean with his head conveniently out of the water for, like, let's say 48 hours, and he's been blipping through time with everyone.
Yeah, similar to the way that
on the water.
Similar to the way that our we see our island crew blip on the water as well, and their boat, the outrigger, goes with them. So whatever debris Jin is on is going to go with him because he's touching it, which I guess is how the rules work.
Provided that his debris was on the appropriate bearing, I don't know.
Sure. Well, he was inside the bubble, I think.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Right,
what we're assuming
definitely.
Is that the explosion threw Jin toward the island into the water, so that he, by the time the island actually moved, he had floated inside the green zone, I guess we could call
it. Oh, yeah. So when the island went bloop, Jin went bloop with them on his little debris. Just
he's
as
just
Dan
been
went
blooping
bloop in his
by
zodiac.
Himself.
Yeah, just blooping through time by himself. That's all.
Unconscious on a raft.
Yeah. Jin's second time surviving a shipwreck and making his way to shore. So he did it in season one.
And once again, he wakes up and does not understand anyone who's talking around.
I know,
him,
he's like, I learned English for this.
Yeah, this time it's because it's the French people. All right, let's go back, though, to where we have a slight plan now from Locke, which is he needs to get everybody back, which means he needs to get off the island. And the only way that Locke knows to get off the island reliably is however Ben got off the island by turning the frozen donkey wheel. So we are headed back to the Orchid, which is the trip that takes us through these time jumps, and which leads to their walk-in in the night in 2004, we've established, and a very bright hatch light pops up, and John Locke's thesis statement for the episode, which we talked about with Neil's fun question, is just that he doesn't want to interfere with that because he needed the pain of all his past experiences to get where he was now. He's building on being shot in the gut, etc., to become the leader of the others jumping through time. But, I mean, I believe him because Terry O'Quinn is badass with that speech. Do we think that, I mean, it's kind of an early antagonist check-in here. Do we think that Locke has a good plan here? Whatever happened, happened. Get to the Orchid.
I mean, I will say this. The Locke speech, which you're right, is great. where he's talking about I needed that pain is further reinforcing the idea of whatever happened happened, which the show is yeah, is now having the show is now having multiple characters tell us this. So this they continue to reinforce that you know, everything that happened matters, and that we can't change anything that happened previously. And yeah, I mean, I guess his plan to go to the Orchid is as good as any plan that anyone has at this point, you know, except for Charlotte, who I think just needs to lay down.
No, I think they give Sawyer the whatever happened in this episode, right? Where he's like, what's done is done.
Yeah, what's done is done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. I mean, we're getting it now from Daniel, and now it's starting to sink in with all these other characters. And yeah, and I also think that isn't this the lesson that the show has taught John Locke, at least so far? I think that's true, which is like,
yeah,
you know, his dealings with his father off the island, all the terrible things that have happened to John Locke in his life, he now believes were training him for whatever his purpose on the island is. You know, it was the universe or life or whatever giving him these hardships to strengthen him so that he can save this mysterious island.
See, whether or not that's true, that's often what I tell myself when I'm feeling like when I start to like have regrets about the past or start to cringe with embarrassment about things that I did. I'm like, no. All that stuff, all those dumb things you did made you who you are now.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to like for that thought experiment to work, you have to like convince yourself that who you are now is good. So like,
are you saying that you can't have gooped someone who then died?
Listen, Boone had to die so that I can be the badass that I am now. No, but like, but yeah, it's what the island has taught John is perhaps like the thesis. I think our listener Grant is the one who floated this idea in our Slack. The thesis of the entire show, where it's you know, like a lot of these flashbacks, especially like the ones we got in season one, were a lot about like mistakes and pain and shame that people had about their actions off island. And I think, you know, what the show, especially in season one, is trying to tell us is like, don't carry the like shame of that. Like, know that that made you who you are, and who you are is going to get you through whatever this island is about to throw at you, unless your name is Shannon or Boone. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like, don't be like Charlie doing a greatest hits before he dies. And it's not about like his mistakes and his heroin and stuff like that. At long last, it's about like other things in his life that built him into who he is. We're learning about all these people and all their humanity and all their mistakes and how that turned them into characters that we're rooting for, very human characters. And that's sort of like the most beautiful sort of overall statement of loss, right? Is like, you could have made mistakes. Maybe you blew up your abusive stepfather / real father. Maybe you like did XYZ. Maybe you magically wished your ex-husband to be hit by a bus, whatever it is, you know, like you are where you are now. So what are you going to do next, sort of thing? Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoever got gooped was gooped, and that's all there is.
Whatever gooped.
You're going to fall up the stairs. You're going to fall down the stairs.
Whatever gooped.
Which, of course, leads to, I don't know, probably the best scene of the episode, which is Sawyer gets to see Aaron be born. That is our Awoo-loo-loo best time travel moment. Back in the quarters, Sawyer watches Kate deliver Aaron. We have another option there, but I think that's the winner.
And it's a lot of it is Josh Holloway's performance. Like, it's his face performance again with the face acting so good in that moment. And in the moment after where John asks him what he saw, and he's like, it's gone.
Worth it, and brings the feels to the island side, which you know, usually we try to pull those tearjerkers off island, but not this week. Okie dokie. Let's talk about the future. where while trying to row their way to the Orchid Station, they get in a gunfight with some people. And those people, apparently Juliet takes one out with her excellent sharpshooting, which, as we discussed off podcast, is apparently another quality, a quality of the others. and then they get blinked out of time and of an outrigger chase into a horrible storm that ended up crashing Russo's science team ship while they were pursuing a signal, which we can remember from Russo's discussion previously, are the numbers being broadcast, the 4 billion beans numbers that caused maybe this whole thing to begin with, lured them in. You get some references to the signal and why they're all there if you are reading the transcript or if you speak French. But otherwise, Jin gets pulled ashore, and there's the big reveal that there is a pregnant young lady who is named Daniel Russo. And do we get to talk about now how Danielle was a scientist who apparently went on some weird, like, let's just follow weird signals in the ocean trip while being like
massively
a
pregnant
trimester? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote in the notes that Russo is leaning all the way in. Yeah. Who says you can't go on a dangerous science expedition when you're super pregnant? Not Rousseau. Hey, listen, in France, they tell you you can drink wine when you're pregnant and also apparently go on dangerous science missions. But yeah, there she is. Mm-hmm. Danielle Russo.
There is the question here, since Danielle met Jin in 1988, why didn't she recognize him in 2004? I think that's a good question, but I also think we know that since we've seen Danielle in the 2004 time, I think a lot happens to her in between here and there.
Yeah. A lot of trauma.
She wasn't quite the same person. It is, and it will be interesting to see, you know, how much more of young Danielle we get, and sort of what she was like before the island traumatized her for 16 straight years.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get to see it, too. We don't actually know. The blips seem to be very plot convenient. So maybe Jin just blips out before, you know, she discovers there's a smoke monster and polar bears or whatever she found that did horrible things. So I wouldn't hold it against her too much if she doesn't remember Jin, because I don't think we really know the full context yet. But we might come back to that question.
Maybe she was like, he looks familiar, but I don't want to be that person who thinks all Asian people look the same, and it's been 16 years of awful time, so I'm not going to be like, hey, didn't I meet you 16 years ago in the past?
Well, maybe she did say that to him, and he didn't understand, because at that point he didn't speak English.
Maybe.
And that was just a scene we didn't see, because why would you show that to us?
I mean, he is also very, like, cracked and dried and sea tousled in this encounter. So I wanted to, I mean, this is of course a perfect opportunity for us to mention that Mira Furlan, who played Danielle Russo for the first four seasons of Lost, passed away this last week. There were some beautiful tributes to her from cast members, and Damon Lindelof and Michael Cicchino posted a beautiful piano piece for her. And it just happened to be a huge coincidence that, you know, Russo in another form returns to the show this week. I don't know. It's a little bit of spooky kismet, some island magic, right? That's our Jungle of Mystery moment.
Yeah. I mean, and that's also the real Giacchino corner this week, because we don't have one for the episode, but you should. That's probably the best one I saw, was that little tribute. It's really good.
It's beautiful.
You know, RIP. She was also on Babylon 5, which I've never seen, but all-timer on Lost.
But it also feels like a good time to mention. So I think we talked a little bit about this in the storm, but probably not in the calm, because we didn't want to like tip our hat to the fact that Danielle Russo shows up in season 5, young Danielle Russo. But we talked a lot about how in season 4, they had certain flashbacks planned that they changed because of the writer's strike, changed their ability to do certain things, and that they had planned to do a Rousseau flashback. You'll remember that she dies pretty dramatically, like, what is it? Either
she dies abruptly right before the break they took.
Yeah. Just right before she dies abruptly, right? So, like, they had planned in that back half to have a Rousseau episode. They don't do it. And so then at Comic-Con between seasons, you know, people ask about Rousseau, and this is a transcript or a write-up from the panel. Damon Lindelof said, "We will say this. You will see definitively this year Rousseau's story, but to use the word flashback would be disingenuous." And Carlton Cuse said, "We're steering away from the word flashback and embracing a whole new word." I mean, I think that's before... Like, they didn't say yet, I think, that they were doing time travel. So they didn't want to be like, you'll see her in a time travel blip to the past.
Time travel blip.
Anyway, so yeah, Carlton Cuse says, "We're steering away from the word flashback and embracing a whole new word. There will still be flashbacks and flash forwards in the show, but we're going to do something different this year. We're going to mix it up." So,
yeah, the word was bloop.
Yeah. Bloop. Bloop. It's like goop, but bloopier. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. All right, Joanna, explain the rest of these notes to me.
Oh, no, I just really like the, Sawyer has some great Linus episodes, and one of them is like, "Oh, the others," which is just a funny line, right? This was the premiere of a supplemental show called Lost Untangled, which aired briefly during Life on Mars, which was a misbegotten American adaptation of a fantastic British show. If you ever have a chance to watch the British show, you should. They tried to make an American version with Harvey Keitel. It was very bad. And I guess it aired after Lost for a little while.
I do remember this. This is something they did. This is the first episode, and then it like goes through the end of the series. But it was like you had to watch the first segment of Life on Mars to get to the Lost explainer.
Right.
Oh my which god, they, that was terrible.
Which according, I mean, I never watched it, but according to Lostpedia, like, they, like, reenacted things with, like, toys. And it sounds very odd. Like, at first I was like, was there some sort of, like, Chris Hardwick-esque Talking Dead kind of Lost show that I didn't know about? Because I know that, like, Entertainment Weekly did their, like, they did some video Lost stuff in the final seasons here. But I wasn't sure what exactly Lost Untangled was. So if anyone wants to write in with their memories of what Lost Untangled was, we would love to know about it. And then my last note was just borne about by the fact that I was watching a Television Critics Association panel today with Don Johnson and thinking about like all the Nash Bridges actors that Carlton Cuse brought over from Nash Bridges onto Lost and how Don Johnson wasn't one of them. But like, I kind of wish he had been, even though he shows up on Watchmen, obviously another Damon Lindelof joint. So my question is just a thought thing, which is who would you have Don Johnson play on Lost if Don Johnson had been on Lost?
As much as I like the actor, Locke's dad.
Yeah, that's the real Sawyer. Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any other answers, Dave?
Yeah. Give him Jacob.
Ooh.
Oh. Don't even know what my opinion of that one is yet here in the call.
It's much better than the horse that we're going to see in a couple episodes.
Yeah. Or maybe he could have played Electro Walt.
Yeah, Electro. I am the Electro Walt. I find this racially problematic. All right. That means that it's time for some more corners.
Oh, actually, I know the answer. It's Horace. He should have been Horace. Let's get creep out of here.
Get Doug Hutchison out of here.
Get Doug Hutchison out of here and recast him Christopher Plummer style with unproblematic king Don Johnson.
Godspeed, John. Again, he probably wouldn't do it crappily. Maybe he would. Well, he gets him. He had to figure it out.
It would have been twinklier. Horace. Don Johnson's always twinkling, you know what I mean?
This week's Jungle of Mystery moment is there's a weird boat chase with some mystery people that Juliet shoots. Is maybe in the future? Question mark. Jungle of Mystery.
I mean, not too far in the future, though, because they're shooting guns and not, like, lasers. So...
Yeah, this would have been a great time to be like, pew! Be like, what the fuck was that?
Go from flaming arrows to two episodes later since the lasers.
Right. That would screw up all the theories, being like, when are we going to get to the lasers?
Yeah, missed opportunity.
Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award. I feel like we have a couple of options here, but I think we got to give it to Boone Carlisle, who dies off screen in this episode from falling down.
Maybe. Yeah. Although I will argue that Jin falling into the ocean from the exploding freighter is that's a further fall, and he stays down a lot long. Well, I guess Boone stays down forever, but Jin stays down a lot longer before anyone helps him.
I will say that if anyone, like, hell math is one thing, but I'm kind of interested in hell physics. If anyone wants to draw me a diagram of Jin's trajectory off the freighter into the bubble of the island as it moves, I would love to see it.
So we solved this problem before with Schrodinger's doctor. There's a Desmond Memorial suckhole of time that was right next to the freighter the whole time. And he just got blown directly into the Desmond suckhole. Mm-hmm. That popped him out in the island.
Well, I mean,
Formally object to the phrase Desmond Suckhole.
Well, no, it's because the rules don't apply to the Desmond Suckhole.
Be like the Hume Vortex instead of the Desmond Suckhole?
The Hume Vortex. That sounds like a real thing.
Uh-huh.
Well, okay,
like,
all
right. If Daniel Faraday were to make a cage of bamboo, I wouldn't call it a Faraday cage. That would be done.
Okay, so, but here's another theory, though. We don't know how much time Jin would have experienced if he were awake. He may have gone through the Hume hole, and it may have only been about 10 minutes. No, we don't know how this works.
You have to play the troll toll if you want to get in the Hume hole. You have to pay the troll toll to get in.
No. Yep.
Yeah.
The I Married Her Coincidence Corner this week goes to Dan Norton, being the only lawyer in all of Los Angeles. Is this a new corner in the calm? It is. We've had it in the storm for a bit, but Joanna successfully lobbied for its migration here, and I like it.
I married her!
I married her! I'm going to try to do better line readings as we go forward. We did our Nosebleed Watch 2021, which means it's time for The Book Club. This is one of those weeks where the title is a book, right, Joanna?
Le Petit Prince, The Little Prince. This is an iconic children's book. Oh my God. Let me make sure I don't butcher my French. Okay. So, they get the wreckage of the Rousseau expedition ship. Sawyer and Locke find it, and it says B612 on it, which is B612, which is the name of the asteroid that the title character from The Little Prince lives on. So that's like a little thing. But also, to all of our benefits, at the time, Jeff Jensen, here's what's funny. I know I referenced Jeff's recaps a lot, but they were, you know, a big part of the coverage of Lost at the time. And what's funny is that, like, so in advance of this episode, he wrote, I guess, a 6-page article on EW.com about the title, The Little Prince, and what it might have to do with the show.
Keep in mind, they had a lot more time on their hands.
Make that money, Jeff.
Well, no, all of his fellow recappers, like, linked to it in their recaps, but they were basically like, ugh, Jeff is exhausting, and he did this thing. So if you wonder what the title means, you go read Jeff's thing. And I was like, I definitely have written several pages articles on the meaning of titles for Game of Thrones. So I was like, I see you, Jeff Jensen. I respect the hustle. I too have done this. What could, the dragon and the wolf mean? Anyway, So The Little Prince, there's a lot to get into here. You know, you've got like a plane crash, you've got a Frenchman, a French pilot, you've got all sorts of stuff. But Jeff really narrowed in on this really interesting theme of the book. And maybe this is overthinking it, but what is life for if not for overthinking things? this thesis of the Little Prince being you become responsible for what you tame, meaning like you become responsible for the things you create ties to, which all goes back to the like idea of the show of this like live together, die alone. There's a lot of lines in this episode that are about like community and the ties that bind, like what are friends for, or are you with me? I've always been with you, and all this sort of stuff, just like all this connective tissue that they formed together. You become responsible for what you tame. You become responsible for the things, the community that you choose, the relationships you form, all this sort of stuff. Kate as responsible for Aaron, who is like the son she has chosen, all this sort of stuff like that. So I think that's a really beautiful connection between that book and Lost. So mm-hmm. The Little Prince. And like The Little Prince, I mean, it's referencing the book. It's fun because it's a French book, and Danielle and her pal show up in this episode, and it's fun because you can think of Aaron as the little prince, of course, of the island. And one other book corner element is that in Sun's dossier that she gets along with her chocolate box gun.
In her kill kit.
There's a Faulkner reference. Faulkner wrote about this made-up county that even though I was an English major, I dare not try to pronounce right now off the top of my head. And it's referenced in the dossier, which I just think is like English majors having fun, honestly. So I don't think there's any thematic significance to it, but it is.
I think if I remember my Lostopedia bullet points, it's actually like material that was derived for a different online like ARG that they kind of like pulled.
Oh, yeah. But at any rate, the reference to this fake county in Mississippi from Faulkner is in that ARG thing. Yeah.
That proves that League of Extraordinary Gentlemen takes place in the same world as all of this.
Yeah, because Vardaman is one of the extraordinary gentlemen, right?
Yes, yeah, sure.
Okay, cool.
All right, Henry Gale Memorial, obviously a lie award. Don't worry about us, Kate. There's candy in the minibar and 100 channels on TV. We're going to be just fine here, says Sun, who then proceeds to put Aaron in a car with a loaded gun.
I mean, I don't know how she is as a mother, but she's a pretty bad babysitter.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to do the Carl's Memorial Coming Right Now Act Break Award, which is actually a heartstring puller, not a Carl coming right now, but Sawyer's don't matter. It's gone now. Taking us out of Act 3, mm-hmm. It's going to get the statue.
Imagine having to sit with that moment for several minutes while also watching early Obama era commercials.
Yeah. It's like, doesn't matter.
What are we
matter.
Advertising
it's
in 2009? Ads for life on Mars?
Look at those, that adult blue bear, and that is teaching that little baby bear how to use toilet paper so it doesn't get poop stuck in its little bear fur. I'm so glad this is animated, because otherwise it would be horribly disgusting.
I wonder if it's possible, and please, host at Storm Podcast, if you can find this. I'm sure someone's tried to find out what commercials ran, what national commercials ran during Lost. It was around Super Bowl time, so they would have been ramping up. Anyway, that's
Doritos commercial.
Oh, yeah. Doritos commercials. But, like, which specific Budweiser commercials?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, like, this is, like, I mean, I don't know that people save their TiVo, their boop-boop TiVo recordings, right? But, like, I have, like, things that I taped off TV, like movies as a kid mm-hmm. in the 80s that I know which Ivory Soap, which Campbell Soup, which whatever commercials ran with it, because I used to mm-hmm. watch them with my taped recording of Wizard of Oz. So, yeah.
It is time to talk about the most important thing we do on this show. Who needs to be kissing each week on Lost? Everybody's attractive. This island's jumping through time. Time is precious. You are responsible for the things you tame. Joanna, how did you do last week for Jughead?
Listen. As we all know, basically the constant of this segment is if certain people are in it, they're going to win it. You know what I mean? Good luck to Jin, who returns, and he was once a two-week champion, but it's tough. All right, so the lack of Ben, the lack of Jack got 10.7% of the vote. Thank you so much. Ellie and her rifle. You remember Ellie. And her rifle, 22.8% of the vote. Locke and Richard, once again, really, really coming in silver. They always claim the silver. Always a bridesmaid, never a bride. Locke and Richard.
The silverest of foxes.
29. Well, Richard's not a silver fox.
He should be, given his age.
I know. So Locke and Richard, 29.5% of the vote. But sorry, everyone else. Penny and Dez were in this poll. So it's 36.9% of the vote to Penny and Dez. I predict a similar predicament this week as we look at who should have been kissing in Le Petit Prince. Like I mentioned, Jin is back in the run, back from the dead, and back immediately back in the Kissery poll. This nomination comes from our listener, Lady B, who suggested, Bronwyn suggested Jin and some chapstick. I don't know if he caught a close look at those little cracked lips on Jin, but he could use some Blistex.
Yeah, definitely use the chapstick. The chapstick before he does any kissing of any other people.
Yeah. Yes. We've got Kate and Sun, who stayed the night together in a hotel room and share clothes. So, you know, maybe something could be happening there. We've got Saeed and Assassin Tony RN.
Oh, we barely talked about the assassin attempts.
I guess I have one question about that, and it's why did he need to shoot him with the darts if he could just give him drugs through his IV? I don't know how assassinations work.
Maybe Assassin Tony RN wasn't a real RN.
He's
go on a limb.
He's incompetent at both jobs. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but he missed, but before he did, he and Saeed exchanged some looks, and it's often hard to tell whether Saeed is sizing you up or wanting to kiss you. I find those looks very similar. Mm-hmm. So there we go. But, last and certainly not least, you got James and Juliet, who share a moment when he talks to her about what it was like to see Kate. She tells him to go away at one point when she's trying to get information out of Dan, and he's yelling and she's like, James, go away. It's a great moment. I called him James and Juliet because she calls him James, and I like the alliteration of their names together. So James and Juliet in the poll. Good luck to everyone else.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to reach like a peak. The peak history will be when we can get James and Juliet and Penny and Dez in the same one.
It's true. Good luck. Kate and Sawyer, Penny and Dez, and Sawyer and Juliet, and Jin and Camping.
Jin's back, so Jin and Camping is back on the menu.
I know, he's camping with some Frenchies now. We'll see how it goes for him.
All right, it's time for our official podcast check-in. There was an official Lost podcast that ABC released in between episodes, usually. Up until now, some fun facts. We've been listening to our official podcast check-ins. They've been using questions that had been asked at the previous year Comic-Con 2008. Last week, we read a question from a Chris of the Boston Skypex who listens to the show and tweeted at us that it was good to hear his question. We found Chris of the Boston Skypex. Welcome back, Chris. You are a dedicated Lost fan if you are doing this with us again now, and thank you for doing it. But this week, they get back to their normal podcasting. They said that they're very busy because they have multiple shows and edits. I believe they said they were breaking episodes 15 and 16 and writing some stuff. So, point being, spotty podcasts coming up. Until they finish actually writing season 5, in which case we get back to our normal podcast schedule. But this week, I have very good news for you from the official Lost podcast. Here we go. Neil is going to read Damon Lindelof. I'm going to read Carlton Cuse.
Right. My final question for you, Carlton, and it's a doozy, so please indulge me. This is from Matt Maniner in the Los Angeles, California, right here. Vincent question. In the episode Outlaws, Locke tells Kate and Sawyer a story about how when he was young, after his foster sister died, a retriever dog appeared at his house and basically helped the foster mom get through it. This is sort of on the axis of reincarnation. So this should activate you. Locke said, once the mom passed away years later, the dog left and went back to where, whatever it came from. I couldn't but notice the similarity between the behavior of that dog and Vincent. Before Walt left on the raft, he told Shannon that Vincent was there for him after his mom died. Then when he gave him to Shannon, he said Vincent could be there for her after Boone died. So my question is it possible that the lab in Locke's story could be Vincent, like a dog version of whatever Richard Alpert is? Or are they totally different dogs and there's just a theme that all labs are just good and good to have around when people die? Does Vincent know who Jacob is?
That's my favorite part. Just sneaking in there at the end and...
Yeah, sneaking in there at the end.
Does Vincent know who Jacob is? Oh, wow.
So there you go, Carlton.
That could be the best question ever. I think those are parallels that those kind of... It's a pretty awesome kind of exegesis of those kind of... The whole Vincent story and finding the parallels to what Locke said is pretty remarkable. But I think by and large, we just think that labs are good dogs.
Does Vincent know who Jacob is? And if he did, how could he tell us? Vincent, bang your paws 3 times if Jacob is Locke from the future.
He might know who Jacob is, but he's definitely not telling.
Okay.
The one thing which we have said, and we would say here for all the fans of the podcast, Vincent will definitely survive till the end of season 6.
So he was not killed in the Flaming Arrow attack. Maybe he's taking care of Rose and Bernard.
He was not. And there's one character that we're going to confirm will make it to the end of Lost, and that is Vincent the dog.
That's great.
So that's you should be very happy. Anyway, well, on that note, these are the dog days of the season, aren't they?
The dog does not die.com.
Yeah.
The dog does not die on Lost.
The dog is eternal. Dog Alpert. Vincent Alpert.
Vincent Alpert.
I'm going to start calling him Vincent Alpert if I remember.
And with that, we're going to close out the calm section of this week's podcast. We will head into the storm right after this.
So now is the time on the podcast where we like to thank our small council Patreon subscribers. That's the folks who are here at the $10 level or above. They watch movies with us. They hang out with us. They get all the bonus podcasts. Here we go. We've got Alicia Maggi, Doug Robson, Christina, Vera Johansson, Gear, Maureen Moore, Rob Perry Hall, Michael R. Cleland. Oh, another Cleland. Cecily Stepney, that's a really fun way to spell Cecily. Matthew, Kaylee Hicks, David Adams, David Moran, AJ Cabbage. Happy birthday, AJ. It was AJ's birthday this week. Del Martinez, Chelsea Doyle, Mark Larson, Michelle Cahill, Ben Grieving, and Christopher Vanjanek. Thank you all so much.
And I would like to thank Gabriel Colorado, Dane Maher, Kate Thrams, Jeff Ruberg, Laura Atiu, Benjamin Jacoby, Reginator Cakes, DJ Empirical, Phil Jackie Meme Lord, Jessica Lair, Manu Mishra, Megan McLeod, David Koplos, Lily Lim, Derek Doc, Vince Lewis, Russell Griffin, Philip Durrett, Tyler Inman, and Karen Einter, thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans. Gregory Gergerian? Yeah, okay. Brandon Lee Tenney, Kelly Stollard, Melanie Rodriguez, Sarah Carmichael, Spencer Howard, Huang Lee, Michael Sample, Jenna Mandel, maybe? Rosa Peretta, Shannon Hurley, Emily Milan, Ashish Sridharan, Kayla Sargent, Annie A.K., J.N. Atwood, Anna Burke, Christina Watkins, Derek Doc again, and Melanie Chu. Thank you all so very much for being members of the small council.
Thanks. Thank you twice, Derek Doc.
Yeah, good job.
And we are back for the storm. I feel like the antagonist check-in. Once again, we're in time-jumping weirdness, and I think we did that in the calm. So we're going to skip that this week to get to the exciting part of this week's podcast, which is we got to the Outrigger episode. Bow, 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 bow. One of Lost's unsolved mysteries.
Sure is.
Wow. Yep.
I mean,
also, we never know. We never find out who ransacked the camp.
Yep, that's true. So how do we feel?
It's all in Lost 2.
Well, yeah, exactly. What Outrigger solution makes you guys feel the best?
Cindy and the kids, I think you mentioned.
I like
Cindy and
the
well-armed children.
I read as much of the Outrigger theories page of Lostopedia as I could, which is not to say all of it, because at some point it's just like every possible option they've come up with. But I also like the idea that sometime in the future, when there's Ajira bottles on the island, before Kate gets Claire back, Claire could have ransacked the camp. I don't think she's in the Outrigger, but she would have known where the camp was. And that makes you feel better because maybe she found the drive shaft.
I was going to say, maybe she found Charlie's ring. Shappy.
Yeah,
Jump so Shappy.
Jump Shappy. That's the one that makes me feel the best about the Outrigger, is that I don't know who's in the Outrigger, but Claire's the one who ransacked the camp, not whoever left the Outriggers there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one I like the most is that it's Ilana and like Caesar and the people that come on the Ajira flight, yeah. And that the first boat is the boat, because doesn't Sun leave with Ben first when they get back to the island? This is me remembering.
I'm not doing this again. I got told you'd by some people for a mistake I made last week, so I'm not playing this game.
But I am completely sure that it is Sun takes a boat first after she knocks out Ben and leaves Hydra Island to come back to the main. So then this could have been Ilana and her crew.
Who sees Men in Blacklock and is like, shoot that.
Sure, dude. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. But weird, yeah, that they never come back to that part of the future.
Well, yeah, also, they had Jorge Garcia record the numbers that the French crew is listening to. That's Jorge Garcia's voice. Mm-hmm. And they said later it's just an Easter egg, but like I have to think that they were like, maybe we figure out a way that the numbers actually originate with Hurley, and then they didn't. So they just left it there as an Easter egg, do you know?
Ooh.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, like, Hurley was at one point. Well, it's at some point in the future going to be the man in charge.
Yeah. I think you could still retcon that and just be like, you know, we have that scene in season one, is it, where Saeed apparently can pull the radio through time, or possibly, if the island is just free moving through time or how it works. So maybe Hurley was the 4 billion beans numbers guy, just through time. Lots of Lost 2 potential in this Outrigger mystery is basically what I'm saying. The only reason I think it really stands out is the rest of the season's pretty well plotted, from my recollection. You guys have rewatched it more recently, but like I don't remember any other big things from like the Lost fandom outside of the Outrigger from season 5. I mean, we could endlessly and will be endlessly debating who killed Juliet, but I mean like big mysteries that the show actually set up.
Yeah.
That could be our transition point, but I do think we it looks like we want to talk a little bit more about Sawyer and Juliet, sort of getting some time here before LaFleur.
Well, I just really love all the buildup that they do. It starts with the like beach moment, which is like a fun, sexy place to start, but then also sad because the freighter is just like smoke on the water. But I love all the work they do leading up to LaFleur to make James and Juliet a really convincing, root forable pair.
Yeah, they would have paired off.
That they just like, yeah, I mean, Sawyer could have chemistry with a leaf, so it's not hard, but, and Elizabeth Mitchell as well, both of them, Josh Holloway and Elizabeth Mitchell, but they spark well together and they just do a lot of work to make them the convincing co-captains of this team, with like John being their like shaman or whatever. But like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they're just kind of like, and whenever there's a tough situation, Sawyer's looking not to anyone from the freighter and probably not to John, but he's going to look to Juliet. So, you know, this whole like, you got my back is going to be a recurring, I think it comes up three times this season, and it's a recurring sort of this team and how they build. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's the pre going Dutch. It's the laying the foundation for the Dutch, the going Dutch.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what I forgot, I think, was how much time they spend with the, give them enough time to like let go of things. You know, like this episode, there's a lot of like Sawyer letting go of Kate, because he's, you know, accepting that she's gone. And then Juliet, in a way, in her own way, is also letting go of this need to leave the island. They are. It surprised me on the rewatch how much work they put into building toward, you know, LaFleur and what happens in the back half of the season. It's good stuff.
And the one thing I wanted to throw in before we get to our emails is, while I was trying to talk myself into my theory of why Kate didn't work, it occurred to me the reason they didn't do that, Kate doesn't run away from Aaron, is because she fucking leaves Aaron and runs away in like a couple episodes. So
leaves him with Kate, his biological grandmother. So
yes,
true.
Know. Which is good, but now I see, you know, why they didn't take the time to like flesh that out, even though I still think that would have been interesting. Even if she acted in the better good to like go get Claire, which I think does read this like middle part of Kate wishy-washiness.
Mm-hmm.
There's not anything anchoring her outside of immediately what she says within the episode. Like, overall character-wise, I feel like Kate's kind of in the storm. All right, but you know what? She didn't kill Juliet, did she?
All right, let's get to some emails. We got a couple Juliet death emails, and I'm really hoping that we keep this up all the way to the end of the season. Before we get to those, let's get to a quick correction. Eric and a number of other people have let me know that I was erroneous in saying the real John Locke and Charles Widmore never shared a scene together, because they share a scene in the life and death of Jeremy Bentham. Charles goes to visit John in the Tunisian hospital after John turns the frozen donkey wheels.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I feel bad that I didn't remember given that I had just watched it like a week ago.
We have that to look forward to. So I was wrong. Yes, I was. Okay. Aww. Here's a very long email, but I think it's good. It's from Michael, and the title is "Whatever Happened Happened is Dumb Except for Desmond." Hainstorm hosts. I love the podcast. It's my go-to listen when cooking dinner on Thursday nights. Y'all are the soundtrack to my boiling pasta. There's a bit of stormy stuff in here, but not a lot. Sorry if this gets a bit long. This is my first time writing, y'all, so I'm going to give with my lost origin story. Actually, I'm going to skip that. It's a very long email, so I'm going to skip that. So here I am listening to a podcast about a show I've watched and mostly being able to follow along with some minor confusion here and there when you focus on things I don't remember well. Allow me to tell you why I extremely dislike the idea of whatever happened happened, except for Desmond. Desmond is cool. My main issue with this concept as presented by the show is that along with it comes this notion that from the universe's perspective, some events are more important than others. If we go back to season 3, we can see Desmond desperately trying to change the future after witnessing Charlie's death. But in Final Destination style, the universe keeps trying to bend things so that this future must absolutely come to pass. But why? Why is Charlie's death so important? The obvious answer is that this is a TV show and Charlie is a major character and his death means something to us, but only because we prescribe meaning to these things, so it makes sense that we would find Charlie's death in season 3 to be far more important than that time Sawyer read some books on the beach. But the universe shouldn't care. The universe trying to bend reality so that Charlie dies over and over again has to cause all sorts of other things to happen that didn't happen, right? Desmond redirects the lightning. He saves Claire so Charlie won't try to do it. The show doesn't seem interested in a butterfly effect style interpretation of time travel, which is fine, but things do change, just not the thing Desmond attempts to change. Hell, if Desmond hadn't tried so hard to save Charlie, they would have never gotten to the point where Charlie was even in a position to sacrifice himself to contact Penny. So maybe the answer is that the island wanted Charlie dead because it knew he was a lying little shit and was a baller swim champ. The island wants to get that piece off the board so that the Oceanic Six can't leave. I suppose you can make that argument, but I don't like it, mostly because the island having a kind of mystical will is fine, but giving it that much sentience just feels like a complete cop-out catch-all for any inconsistency with the show. So we can probably chalk that whole thing up to Desmond being a radical element in the timeline because his magical chest hair, the buttons let you know how much he's holding back his true power, like weighted clothing in anime. If we ignore the Charlie stuff due to Desmond being an anomaly, we are left with good old Dan. He repeatedly says that you can't change things because of this core tenet, that whatever happened, happened. But that can't be true because anything our time-traveling losties do is guaranteed to change something unless we subscribe to such an incredibly strict definition of destiny that free will is all but abolished. If Locke had decided to shoot Widmore in this last episode, would the universe conspire to have Widmore miraculously survive the wound? Sidebar, yes, that's what happened with Ben, right? Or did John have absolutely no choice in the matter? If John had no choice and would never have shot Widmore, then the stakes are completely gone and there's no drama in the scene. If John did have a choice, then there needs to be a consequence to his choice. If John shoots Widmore and Widmore lives because he isn't dead in the future, then the universe has decided that Widmore being alive is important. Is Widmore having a scar from the wound not important? What if he gets some kind of permanent injury from the attack? There's so many different ways that confrontation can play out that still result in Widmore being alive and able to carry out his actions later in life. Or maybe it's important that Widmore absolutely must not die and not be injured, but you can hurt his feelings a bit by having Richard take his gun away. I feel like this entire thing gets really messy, but then most time travel stories do just by their very nature. Now take that single moment. Take all the countless ways that go and add to that every other thing our losties do while jumping through time. Hurley and Miles talking to Pierre Chang. Sawyer stepping on an ant. Hurley taking a whiz on a tree. Them causing the incident in the past, thus ensuring that they get to the island in the future so they can get to the past to do the thing. Time loops are fun, and I like the stuff with Locke and the compass because it's fun and smaller stakes. But I think I prefer the idea that we should try to avoid changing too much just in case we cause more some unintended consequences over this idea that the future is immutable. Otherwise, the universe is just one giant time loop with no exit ramp, and that makes it all so small and boring. So where's the line? How important do you need to be for your fate to be unchangeable? Do you need to be a candidate? If they had tried to save Frogert, would they have been doomed to fail? Or is he such a bit player, sorry, Neil, that he's beneath, that he's the beneath the notice of the time travel rules? Jacob is so hands-off.
Oh, no, he's definitely beneath the thing.
Jacob is so hands-off with this whole battle between good and evil that I don't really see him being in charge of these decisions. So we have two equally bad options and one other that I hate, but your mileage may vary, I suppose. Number one, the island has an extremely specific destiny that it will bend reality to ensure comes about, thus making free will not a thing. Number two, whatever happened, happened. Every action in the past is something they definitely always did, causing a complete time loop for everyone forever, thus making free will not a thing. Number three, Dan is completely wrong about how all this works, but the show isn't interested in actually explaining how any of it works, making the rules wishy-washy, lowering the stakes both for the plot and the characters because at any time, any old thing could happen, allowing the writers to bullshit their way out of any quarry they write themselves into. Future Locke could just show up at any moment with a sword and an eye patch and announce that he was the antagonist all along. I would love to hear any counterpoints you might have had to this because it's something that's been bothering me since you all started talking season 5 and I need to get it off my chest. Have I completely missed a solution to this convoluted nonsense? One final point that I think would be cool and I'd love to get your takes on. Later in the show, baby Ben Linus is shot and his healing at the stupid temple is given as the reason why he didn't remember being shot or that it was Saeed who shot him. Maybe the one time he wasn't very good or he didn't finish the job. It's also why he doesn't recognize Sawyer as LaFleur. My headcanon was always that Ben did remember. He knew exactly who these people were, and it's why he treated them like shit the whole time. Imagine being Ben and getting dragged into a hatch in the middle of the jungle, locked in a small room, and suddenly the man who almost killed you as a child is there, and he starts torturing you for information. I'd probably try to ruin that dude's life at every opportunity if I were Ben, and we know Ben loves withholding information. So it's not that unbelievable that he'd keep that one close to his chest. I just think it makes him even more dastardly than he already was, and it's fun to think about even if it's not technically accurate. I, for one, love the long podcast and the long storm, so keep it up. Sincerely, Michael. So that is Michael's long question about time travel. We touched on this like very glancingly about this idea of whatever happened, happened, removing some of the stakes, specifically as Dan was talking about the bomb. Like, we're never worried the bomb is going to go off because we know it doesn't go off then. So we know that the island is still there, so it didn't happen. So what do you think of these problems that Michael has presented with the time travel narrative?
What type of answer would you like, Joanna? Would you like an answer that's about storytelling, or would you like an answer where I try to make him feel better about time travel?
Both.
Okay, well, storytelling, it's absolutely, they could do whatever they want. It's a great theory, and it's the thing I tried to explain earlier about, like, some of the, on an earlier episode of the podcast, about some of the risks of doing a time travel, type of story, which is it cuts down on the type of drama. The, like, ability of characters to do unexpected things is either going to be about you withholding the fact that they could do that from the audience, or breaking your rules in some sort of point if you want it to be, like, an actual in-universe, making sense with how we understand time travel and physics sort of way. I think it really neuters story. See the movie Tenet, which works and is very boring, I think, because it works so well. Because you have to neuter all the characters in order to make a time travel story work that well. And the thing that I would make you feel better about actual physics is if you start Googling about the fifth dimension. We know the fourth dimension is time, but the fifth dimension is theoretical, and it was additionally theoretically developed by mathematicians. I'm looking at Wikipedia. It says the German mathematician Theodor Kaluza. That's probably not how you pronounce it in German. Anyway, they were searching for a theory that would unify the fundamental interactions between gravity and electromagnetism. So, you have time, and you can't change time. It's not that time sees certain events as more important, it's that time doesn't see time as changeable. If we're third-dimensional beings moving linearly, or in the case of Lost, skipping through time, those are all experiential things, when in theory people would jump back to fixed events in time that already happened. The exception here could be moving Tesseract-like through time through a fifth dimension, because the island has such a strong magic electromagnetic force. So someone like Desmond, when he's changing time, he's not changing time in the fourth dimension. He's changing time in the fifth dimension. So time doesn't change. Whatever happens, happens. He's just fucking with something in a state that it's harder to observe. So it's like if you look at an apple in 3D space, and then you leave that apple in the sun for 5 weeks, and you come back and you look at it in 3D space, the fourth dimension has changed how you perceive the third dimension. The three dimensions themselves didn't act on the apple. The fourth one did, if that makes any sort of sense. The solution to make it feel better is to assume what Dan says is true and then bump Desmond up into another mystery storytelling thing. Does that work?
Yeah, I mean, except for Desmond.
I mean,
I think that I think this idea that, like, it's conferring importance on certain events and not others is a good one. To me, it feels, yeah, like a bit... I find time travel stories really fun, but you run the risk of really complicating things. See, like, what happens to the Terminator franchise after the second Terminator. You know what I mean? Like, if you have a causal loop, you can get away with it for a little while. And this idea of, like, a closed loop forever, as the as Michael's email mentioned, is not all that interesting, at least in Terminator. Like, things keep changing a little bit. You know what I mean? But I think it is, and we'll get to it when we get to the scenes with Miles and Hurley that are very meta about time travel in the upcoming episodes, that this is the writer's way of having, of doing fun time travel, but not having to worry about their viewers having to track butterfly effect changes into the future of the show, right? So they're like, we can have our adventurers muck around in the past, but we don't have to worry about what that does to change season one or anything like that. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I thought it was a great email. Thank you, Michael. Hopefully I didn't butcher it. All right. Do you want a Juliet death email?
Do I?
All right. This one comes from Althea. And Althea writes, trigger warning, I suppose this email starts with a sort of upsetting incident, but it is related to the whole thing. So, just so you guys know. Hi guys, I guess I'll start with my Lost origin story. I first watched Lost in 2004 while sitting on my couch post-miscarriage. After the first 2 to 3 episodes, which I didn't watch when they first aired, had such high ratings and critical acclaim, they reran them one weekend. It was the weekend I was on the couch feeling sad and crampy. I watched, was hooked, and loved. I watched every episode as it aired from then on out. I did a 2-season rewatch in 2006, went home on maternity leave after my first son was born. Then I was about 9 months pregnant for the series finale, always worried I'd miss it if I went into labor early. Then I rewatched the whole series while on maternity leave after son number 2 was born. I only just rewatched it again this summer while stuck at home with my now 14 and 10-year-old sons, and we all enjoyed it together. Man, time flies. Maybe because so much of my Lost viewing experience is tied up in baby having and maternity issues, Juliet quickly became my favorite character. Maybe because she's just an all-around badass. Maybe both. Anyway, here's my contribution to the Juliet death email oeuvre. I think there are a lot of complaints that Juliet's insecurity and jealousy in the back half of season 5 are out of character. But I disagree. I think they are instead a reversion to pre-Island Juliet. She had no self-confidence, a douchey ex-husband, who is it implied, it is implied, has a pattern of parading a series of younger, hotter chicks. Side note, this is like Dolly Parton singing about Jolene. You are Dolly effing Parton. Don't worry about Jolene. Ditto Juliet effing Burke. Anyway, she clearly has insecurities in her relationships. See how quickly she drops Jack when it's clear he's still into Kate. And to that, she got a front row seat to Sawyer's grief at thinking Kate was lost in the freighter explosion. Sawyer tells Horace he imagined her Kate every night for a while. I'm sure Juliet knows this. Sawyer probably told her, cried on her shoulder in early Dharma times. Add to that that Juliet knows everything about Sawyer's past. She knows he's a con man. She knows he's never had a real relationship before. So, of course, her insecurities boil over. My one complaint, and it's a big one, is her turn on a dime from leading the Great Sub Escaped to changing her mind because Sawyer looked at Kate. I would much prefer the story if Sawyer led the Great Sub Escape. It also keeps with Sawyer's character development. I kind of hated how after 3 years of living with the Dharma Initiative and keeping them safe, he was all okay and going off on the real, off to the real world with Juliet with nary a look back, especially after Kate says they're all going to die in a nuclear explosion. If he led the escape and Juliet went along reluctantly because it was the right thing to do and make her changing her mind much less jarring and out of character, while also keeping Sawyer in the keep them safe LaFleur role instead of reverting to what's in it for me, Sawyer. To sum up, Juliet's insecurities, not out of character. Juliet changing her mind in the incident, bah, lame. Love your podcast. It's been a great quarantine companion. I discovered it through Alan Sepinwall's Twitter. Oh, thanks, Alan. I love that it is thoughtful and takes the show seriously and also goofy and makes fun of the show when that is warranted, which is often, as much as I love it. And I propose that the Charlie Pace Last World Final Words Memorial be retired at Juliet's Come On, You Son of a Bitch! Because there's no topping that. Thanks so much for all your hard work. Podcasts are keeping me sane. So... that is less of like a who killed Juliet email and more of Juliet. I mean, I actually I'm gonna pair this with another email from Rebecca, which is a similar theme. I've always been an impatient spoiler hound who used to ask her friend in the U.S. to send her Lost spoilers a couple days before it aired in the U.K., so naturally I finished my rewatch a while ago but continued to enjoy the podcast. The recent discussion on Juliet's death brought to mind a realization I had during my rewatch but was feeling a little shy about sending it in. Then when Joanna requested more Juliet death emails, I knew I had to, particularly since my thought relates to this week's episode, The Little Prince. Juliet is my favorite character in the show, and I was devastated when she died, just as we all were. I remember seeing some discussion online at the time about her apparent jealousy of Kate being out of character, which you also touched on, and at the time I completely agreed. On rewatch, however, one thing that stood out to me was that I think the writers laid more groundwork for Juliet's feelings towards Kate than they are perhaps given credit for. Juliet was present when Sawyer and Kate were locked up at the cages on Hydra Island, so she's had an idea of the depth of their relationship for some time, and she's continued to watch it unfold in her time with the survivors. I think The Little Prince is a great example of that, since she is clearly aware of how much seeing Kate affects Sawyer and asks him about it. With that in mind, it's maybe not surprising that she feels a little threatened by Kate's return, since she's a very clear picture of just how much Kate has meant to Sawyer. I do agree that Juliet's story could have been written differently and she didn't have to die, but I just wanted to offer up a perspective that hadn't really been discussed for your Stormy section, which can never be too long, in my view. Thanks again, and keep up the great work. Rebecca. So this is more about, like, the Juliet... I mean, basically, they, like, try to bring back the love triangle, but make it Kate and Juliet and Sawyer. I've said before that I don't really like it. These two listeners feel a little differently about it. Do you guys, I mean, I know, Dave, maybe you haven't refreshed yourself on it recently, but do you guys have any thoughts on that?
I agree, especially in the first email, about the, there's sort of an abruptness to the change in Juliet, especially given that they were about to just escape on the sub. And yeah, I think it's clear that, like, the Kate thing, they definitely bring back the triangle. I still don't feel bad about, I mean, I still, Juliet's final moments still feel right in the sense that Juliet does kind of feel like the kind of character who would save the day. So I'm not, I don't know. Maybe I'll feel better. Maybe I'll feel differently when we get back to it at the end of the season. But other than feeling a little quick, there's still nothing about Juliet's death that really haunts me.
I guess for me, the Kate and Juliet thing is frustrating because it's like, I understand it. I do think that they do lay groundwork for Juliet being aware of Sawyer's connection to Kate. It's just frustrating because, like, it's been 3 years. Like, we don't see it, but Juliet and James spent 3 years together. And I don't think, you know, they were in a relationship necessarily right away. But, like, you know, whereas Sawyer knew Kate for, like, a couple of months, very intense mm-hmm. months, but not very long before she leaves in the timeline of the show. So, like, I'm disappointed in him and his, like, weird longing looks that he gives her because he's definitely put her in some sort of, like, the one who got away slash, you know, whatever. But it bothers me that Juliet, who's so smart, doesn't see that for what it is, which is, like, some external bullshit and not really having anything to do with, like, the core of their relationship. Do you know what I mean? And it frustrates me that she makes these big life and death decisions based on that. It's one thing for her to be, like, insecure and touchy around it, but there's just, like, some big moves she makes related to that jealousy that frustrate me, you know? And once again, it takes a really smart character and makes her motivations, like, kind of frustratingly stereotypically female, if that makes sense. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I need to think about it. Dave, do you have any thoughts having not rewatched this season very recently?
No, basically the thing you said about it, they have 3 years, so it might feel more forgivable to us and to me because it's a TV show that is plotted to make these things happen. And obviously, based on those two emails, it sounds like they get tripped up, and what Lost occasionally gets tripped up in is, like, we need a character to do something for 1 hour that seems kind of out of, you know, whack, and then we're just going to kind of breeze past it because the story has to move forward. That's going to be my guess, but let's see what happens as I actually roll through this Juliet switch. Got to get back to Dharma first.
All right. And last email. This is not Juliet related. This comes from Holly. Thanks for the incredible podcast about my favorite show. I've seen Lost several times, start to back, and somehow always still find new things about it or things I thought I understood but apparently don't, as you'll see shortly. You have several months before we'll get to the relevant episode of the show, but I thought this might be something worth tracking as we begin to meet Jacob and his brother in their various forms. I always viewed Across the Sea as a sort of origin story for the Smoke Monster, but was recently told by a very enthusiastic and eager to correct me, Lost fan, that the old clickety-clack actually predates Jacob and his brother, and that the Man in Black is just the latest in the line of vessels for the monster. I was wondering if you had any insights on this before we get there, or would be willing to keep it in mind as we get more clues. P.S. I've tried to leave an iTunes review several times. Each time you say there aren't any new ones. I'm sorry, Holly. But I've never heard it on the podcast, so I think iTunes really doesn't want you to know how much you are loved, which is a real bummer because your chemistry and running jokes and insights into the show I've loved for over a decade have made me love it even more deeply, even if some of the mysteries make even less sense under close examination. Thanks and keep up the great work. So Holly wants to know if we have thoughts about the old clickety-clack and his origin.
I mean, I definitely think that the energy that is inhibited within the old clickety-clack is older than Jacob and the Man in Black. But I don't know if, like, like, to me, there's like an energy to it that has taken different forms, you know, and obviously we see it, you know, take the form of John Locke here, before this thing's all said and done. So yeah, I just don't think, like, what do you think it might have been before it was a column of black smoke?
I mean, I always thought that, I think, and this is one of the, listener email came in, that talked about it as like, the island has like a pure magic in the light, and it isn't until that magic is like exposed to the man in black who's just been murdered by his brother, that it manifests the smoke monster for the first time out of like trauma. I don't think it's like a ghost situation, or I don't like the idea of the ghost situation. I like the idea that like the island magic can be good and it can be bad, and humans touched it and fucked it all up. That reads better to me than like a benevolent god magic that, you know, is trying to do good for everybody, and then, you know, it also has this bad side and it fights within itself, which might be better, but it's, since it's god magic, that gives it like a sentience and a flaw that I don't like. I like in terms of the story of Lost, and especially about Across the Sea, is that as soon as the island is exposed to the man in black's trauma, it replicates everything about that story. It replicates the births, it replicates the, you know, the crashes, it replicates drawing in pregnant women. The island is reliving the trauma as much as Jacob and the man in black are. So I would say that we actually see the beginning of the evil force here. But I have asked sort of the reverse of this question a lot, especially when we joke about like Lost 2, which is, if they do like actually kill the man in black version that we see the whole story of in this 6 seasons, would another one manifest on the Hurley Walt Ben version of the island to like establish balance, or are we living in a golden age of good island?
I think we're living in a golden age of good island, because my understanding is also that Jacob's sin of killing his brother is what creates the smoke in the first place. I don't think it predates the, you know, Titus Welliver as a vessel. that's my understanding. And it seemed backed up by the bit of research I did before we recorded today. But I think we're in a smoke-free era with Hurley, but I imagine once again, like, we'll have the Hurley era and we'll have the Walt era maybe. But then someone will eventually take over that is as fallible as Jacob is, and will do something as...
The island will have its own Trump, is what you're saying.
I mean, I think it's
never going to be a woman, but they're going to have bad dudes in there.
Found a way to work it in. I think it's just cyclical. That's what I think. And there was a long cycle of Jacob and the smoke monster. But I don't see Hurley or Walt. Maybe Walt, he has a lot of trauma. But like, I don't see Hurley or Walt doing what Jacob did. But it's possible that one of their successors down the line might. And then another smoke monster would be born.
So then, okay, I like this one. Because, so then what that assumes is the island has the power to create these monsters. But only if a human screws up.
I think so. It's sort of like an original sin kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like falling... Mm-hmm. You know, the fall in the garden, or Jacob and Esau and stuff like that. You know what I mean? That, like,
follow-up question. Would it be a different kind of monster, you think? Is the type of monster that it manifests based on who does the manifesting?
On the color.
Or what sort of crime?
The shirt that the person is wearing when they die. A red smoke monster.
Or is it like one of those things that like it reveals the soul of the person who is like killed? Ooh. So like the man in black's soul was just dark.
Okay.
I don't like that in terms of like a trauma reading. I would almost say like, much like if something bad happens to you and you need to heal, people can tell you things are fine as much as possible, but you have to sort of like learn your way to being fine. I think like when Jacob kills the man in black and exposes him to a light, they both then have to live by these rules that they made up. Like, it's their belief in the rules that makes them like rules. So in that sense, I think that he became like a smoke monster just because he was like formless black anger, and then, you know, over time he learned how to become other shapes. So I don't know, like, I think you'd just be like emotion, like raw emotion.
Anyway, please email us more Julia death thoughts, smoke thoughts,
outrigger
mystery thoughts, things that Neil definitely got wrong about the plot, but definitely not anything that I got wrong about the plot, and we'll go from there.
Make me explain my never a woman joke so it doesn't sound like I'm not just a misogynist. It was about being president. Not important. All right. That feels like we're, you know, wrapping up The Little Prince. Neil, where are we headed next week for a very not ominous sounding episode?
Yeah, I was going to say, wherever it is that we are going, the episode title tells us that this place is death. And for those of you who are in the storm who already know this, you know that it is a Sun and Jin episode. And it's a pretty good one. I feel fondly about this one, despite its ominous title.
And until this place is death, where can people find more of your work around the internet? We're going to start this week again with Joanna Robinson.
Oh, you can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I do a podcast called Still Watching, where we are covering WandaVision. I do a podcast called Little Gold Men, where we're talking about award season movies in this very weird year. And then, you know, the bonus stuff that we do for The Storm, like Gen Pop or Feels Like the First Time. So there you go.
And Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com on Twitter at rejects or at One Perfect Shot. I was actually just organizing a bunch of lost shots for One Perfect Shot today. It's very cool. But most importantly, for folks who listen to this podcast, if you are not a member of our Patreon, do that. Get into our Slack. The channel is Stream Together, Watch Alone. We are speeding our way toward the end of Deadwood, and it's getting really good. So, that's where I will be every day.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, talking about stuff, including the Wilds, if you're still listening, dear Ian Mueller. And also every week, right here at the end of a long podcast about Lost, reminding you to not fall down.